Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I will be your host for the next hour or so. It's a pleasure to be with you. Thanks for joining. I've got a great interview for all of you listening to this episode. We're going to be speaking with author Andrew Smith, talking about his new book, Devil in the Stack, A Code Odyssey. And it's, as you're going to hear in this interview, I'm excited about this book. And as I told Andrew, and you're going to hear this as we start out, the quick pitch that I described to a friend was that Andrew is, I guess we could say, a non-techie, a writer, a career journalist and author who decided in his 50s to learn how to program a computer, to learn computer programming, also known as coding. And the book tells a story of what happened next, how he explored how coding affects us, those of us who program, and affects all of us in terms of how technology affects society at large. And along the way, it dives into a history of computing and goes into neuroscience and some reflections on what this all means. It's a wide-ranging and very well-written book. You can see the cover and a link to the book on the playlist, which you can get to at tectonic.fm, T-E-C-H, tonic.fm. Also, you can get to it if you go to WFMU.org and click Playlists and Comments, which is where we have the AccuPlaylist and the live listener comment board where listeners are chatting away and you can join them right now. Let's go ahead and listen to that interview with Andrew Smith, and we'll get into it, and then I think I'm going to have a few minutes after the interview to say a few more words about my thoughts on what he covers in the book. Again, this is going to be an interview with Andrew Smith, author of Devil in the Stack, here on Tectonic. Andrew Smith, welcome to Tectonic.
Hey, I'm so pleased to be here. Thank you, Mark.
Sure thing. I have to say, I loved your new book, Andrew. It's called Devil in the Stack, A Code Odyssey. This is your third book. It just came out. It's published by Grove Atlantic. And here's how I described the book to a friend. I said, Devil in the Stack is a book about a 50-something guy who learns to code for the first time. And this is what happened next.
Yeah, that's great.
And that's an entry point. But There's a lot more to the book than this. You're exploring computer programming, otherwise known as coding, how coding works, the communities that have formed around specific coding languages, the history of coding, and my personal favorite thread throughout the book is the effects of coding on the world. For anybody who wonders why we need a book about all these aspects of coding, I thought you put it well in the prologue. You wrote, quote, computer code is seeping unchallenged and at an accelerating rate into every area of our existence, which is totally true and thematically consistent with this show. So, Andrew Smith, how do you describe to people the importance of coding and why you spent 5 years of your life writing this book?
Yeah, I mean, it's important to say that I had no background in this at all, no technical knowledge. I basically first got exposed to code way back when I was a journalist. I worked mostly in Britain, worked for The Guardian, Observer, Sunday Times, The Face magazine. And I still carried on doing the odd piece of journalism sort of in this century, although I was mostly writing books. And there was a point where Bitcoin appeared. And I got wind of it quite early on, and no one I knew had heard of it or knew what it was. And when I want to find out about something, what I still sometimes do is call an editor or two and just say, can I write something about this? And eventually, once I'd explained what it was and they'd gone, what, really? Are you sure? They said, yes. So I wrote this piece. And one of the things I was trying to do was work out, who did this? Why did they do it? What's their agenda? And what individual would just come and drop this in the world and then disappear? And there wasn't really much to go on, but there was 100,000 lines of computer code, the program itself. As I started to look at that, knowing nothing about it, I started to talk to programmers. The world that they started to unpack for me was so different from what I expected. It was so much richer and more kind of subtle and nuanced and huge as well. There were all these thousands of computer languages with maybe two or three dozen major ones, and they all had their own communities and their own what you're doing with a programming language, as you know very well because you studied it, is we're representing the world in code. The method by which we do that, by which each language does that, incorporates the whole way of seeing the world, because you're saying, well, okay, what does the world look like? How does it work? Okay, we'll represent it in that way. So assumptions are made throughout. And one of the things that I did learn as I later thought, wow, this is really interesting. After 2016, I thought, wait a minute, I need to go and understand this now. As citizens, we need to understand this because decisions are being made left, right, and center that affect us in everything we can do, in everything we do. Because a piece of software doesn't just make things possible, it also blocks off some things that you might like to do. Someone else has made that choice for you. And so I decided the only way to do it was be going, I'm obviously in my 50s, to go and learn about this stuff for the first time. What I found was precisely that each of the languages has their own culture, they're like complete subcultures. And some I hated. The first one I tried was JavaScript, and anyone who knows code will groan at this point.
Yeah, when you wrote about that, diving into JavaScript first, I'm reading and I said, oh, Andrew, no, don't do it.
I wish someone had said that to me right at the beginning. Because I just thought, to me, it looked so ugly on a screen. I just thought there was no elegance to it. And it just kind of Wild West. There were 14 ways to do everything. Well, how can you decide what to do? And then everyone's code looked different. And I actually, at that point, not knowing too much about it, just thought, I don't have the brain for this. There is a kind of coding mind that you have to have. And we have the popular culture images, don't we, to reinforce that. So the sitcom Silicon Valley, these are all kind of slightly, not socialized, a little bit binary in their thinking, awkward with people. And, Russian Doll has that, Mr. Robot has that. If you've watched Slow Horses, the British one, there's the coder in it's, I mean, if you haven't seen it, you should have a look. But there's a coder in that, and the coder is that guy. You just don't like him. He's just horrible. And so to begin with, I thought, I can't do this. And then someone said, well, look, try a different language. Try Python.
Yep.
And
I always like annotating the books I read for the show. And I mean, this is early in the book. You're saying, what language should I start with? I thought. And I wrote in the margin, Python, obviously.
Python. Well, it took a little while for someone to tell me that. And they said, look, talk to this guy named Nicholas, who ended up being a kind of companion all the way through. We're close friends now. And that I really liked because the assumptions that was making about the world were ones that I could share. And the language, not coincidentally, it was written by a really lovely Dutchman named Guido van Rossum, who I know very well now. His kind of the reason for making Python as it was, he realized that code is read more often than it's written, because we're all working with each other's code. And it's a very elegant language. It's very clear. It looks nice on the screen. I really like it. And the assumptions it makes about the world are about communication. And it contains assumptions about what the world could and should look like. And so I like that. And once I'd done that, I was kind of away. And I know several languages now. But that early part where you're trying to think your way into the way the machine works is very difficult and very awkward for most of us, because it's kind of binary, and each line of code roughly corresponds to an instruction to the machine. So you can't just say, look, fetch me that glass of water over there. You have to go extend the arm, angle the hand, move 3 feet to the left. And this isn't how we operate in the analog world, is it?
Yeah, for myself, I wrote my first programs in BASIC, like a lot of people my vintage who later got into computers. And that was a very easy entry into that thinking. I encountered Python pretty early on in its existence. I remember it was 1994
Right.
I was at an internship and my office mate said, have you tried this new thing called Python? And writing code in Python, I mean, I was somewhat experienced in C and some other languages, but Python, just as you wrote in this book, Devil in the Stack, Python was friendly and is friendly. It's inviting. I wouldn't say it's beautiful to look at, but just from a glance, it's well-structured. It looks organized, and it looks like something that is readable or at least more parsable than these long strings of JavaScript that you were describing before. And even later in the book, you talk about getting into Perl, which has its own values and own reasons why people like Perl. I don't mean to denigrate Perl and the Perl community, but it does objectively look very different from this well-structured, nicely indented Python code.
And one interesting thing about that is actually that I ended up in a discussion, and the book ends up in a discussion about modernism and postmodernism, which I have to say, I did not expect to be going there with computer languages. But the guy who designed Perl, Larry Wall, specifically designed it in opposition to Python as a postmodernist language. So there should be many, many ways to do things. You kind of please yourself in the way that you write the code, and other people are then going to have to try and figure it out afterwards. But it gives you freedom. So His guiding principle was there should be the maximum freedom for the coder, the programmer, to express themselves. And he's like a lot of Perl programmers, actually. He said, well, Python limits it too much. Python doesn't give you this freedom. You're having to code like everyone else, which is the thing that I like about it. So different minds actually suit different languages. It's interesting, isn't it?
Totally. And different political philosophies are embraced by different people.
Yeah.
The other resemblance that I detected in this discussion about Python versus Perl is it reminded me of those old discussions back in the 90s about Macs versus PCs. Because Apple Macintosh at the time was this clean, inviting, friendly, easy to use, well-organized space of an interface. Whereas PCs, despite Bill Gates' best efforts to make a clone of the Mac interface, really the advantages of PCs were the wild extensibility of the hardware and the ability that advanced users had to get into the guts of the machine, which was much more difficult on a Mac. Those two camps were fiercely divided, and there was very little intersection between those two mindsets.
Which was interesting. In the UK, particularly when the internet sort of appeared, and even pre the web, where I was at that time, I was living in London, that was mostly picked up on the club scene, the nightclub scene. So some of the trance techno clubs and stuff like that, they called themselves zippies, which was hippies with computers in their like acid house times. And I was on that camp, and it was all PCs because we didn't have the money for Apples. They were expensive. And the PCs, I had friends on the club scene who'd just build them for you. And, you know, they'd just get the parts, and for a few hundred pounds, they'd build you a PC clone. And so it was really literally two camps in that.
And you talk about friendships you made, by the way, when you went to the PyCon conference full of Python coders.
That does bring us to one thing, which is the open source system, which is incredible. And I spent a lot of time diving into that. And going to PyCon and finding this community of people all focused on the same thing was really revelatory to me. And that was the point at which I thought, oh, I like these people. I want to be one of them. And I do consider myself part of the Python community now, and also a musical language called SuperCollider. And I loved the way the consciousness of the community itself and their, you know, coders have a reputation for being antisocial, as I noted earlier. Well, their community is all about being as social as possible. You go to PyCon and you'll learn to do all kinds of things like, you know, write a little AI program to train a water rifle at a squirrel as it moves towards your bird feeder and then fire it. And I loved all that, the whimsicality of it too. But the open source, the ideal is incredible, where people, I mean, it's someone, was it Steve Ballmer, called it communism and anti-American, because the idea is that everyone, we all go and work on something together for no, usually no credit, sometimes some credit, but just to make the community stronger and to make tools that we can all use, and that everyone, I mean, there is a kind of socialistic attitude, aspect to it, looked at in that way. And it's incredible. I mean, it's remarkable. But one of the things I also found was that it's riven with the same kind of culture war clashes that everything else is. And actually, right at this minute, I fear for it a little bit. I'm afraid unless it improves, we could lose it.
I love what you said before, that Steve Ballmer, the old, what was he, president of Microsoft in the Bill Gates era. A good rule of thumb, by the way, take it from me, I've been in the tech industry for a long time. If it has to do with computing at all, and Steve Ballmer is against it, it's going to be awesome.
Agreed. Absolutely agreed. Yeah.
I mean, you could just take that to the bank. If he's against it, you should definitely support it. I mean, Listen to what he's saying. Oh, open source is terrible. It's communism. And what does that mean? It's people working together and actually doing something as a community that benefits the world. He can't stand that stuff. All he knows is building a monopoly. Okay, I got to get out of rant mode.
Which you can see that is the guiding principle of much of corporate America, actually.
Yes, yes. And throughout this book, you're writing about these different mindsets. And again, what we're saying, how an approach to code is really mirrored in an approach to how society works, or how these various institutions, communities, or corporations work. And let me say, there is no love for Mark Zuckerberg in this book, which I appreciated. Facebook comes up again and again. You have a very a very clever sense of humor that comes through in this book, Andrew. And whenever Mark Zuckerberg is mentioned, you know there's going to be a little mini roast shortly.
Yeah, I think I call Facebook a wind turbine for psychosis, which I think it is.
Yes, quite a wind turbine. Not the wind turbine that we want in our alternative energy source, but there we have it. There's another aspect to these coding cultures that you spent some time on, and that is the participation of women and underrepresented minorities. You write about a recent decline of women in computer science, and you talk about the industry as, quote, an industry in which 7% of coders are female and under 3% are black. And there's an average age of 28 in the U.S., with almost three quarters having no dependents. We're getting, from these statistics, a view onto the average. Of course, it's only a generality, but an average coder, if there is such a thing, young, white, male, unmarried. You write very persuasively about why that is a risk, not just to corporations, but to all of us, if code is being written only by one demographic slice in the country.
You're right. And there was, I can't remember who it was now, but it was a woman who'd been quite senior in the tech industry, once made a quip about most of what the software companies in startups in Silicon Valley were doing was trying to make applications that would do for the people programming them all the things their moms used to do.
Yeah, I remember that.
It was
yes.
Very funny.
Wash my clothes with a button press.
Exactly. Deliver my groceries so that I don't have to shop. But that, you know, that is a fascinating thing. And one of the things that I found most transporting about all the research I did for this was going back into the history of it. And it is so much more fascinating than even most people, you know, within because programming takes time and is quite difficult to learn, though I do believe anyone can do it if they want to. But because I think it's so all-consuming when you're learning, we never teach anyone where it's come from. And one of the things that I was hoping to do with this book is introduce a kind of sense of historicity, so people feel like there's a tradition that they're coming from. And if you feel that you are coming from a tradition, you're not just being conjured out of the air, which is often what the way people talk in the industry, that there's a responsibility then to that tradition. And it goes right back to the beginning. Everything that happens, absolutely everything that happens on a computer is built on a system of logic that was developed by a poor cobbler's son with no formal education in Lincoln in England, who was born in 1815. And he made this huge logical leap. Logic hadn't really evolved much since Aristotle at the time. He developed this form of language of algebra that was a century later used in switching theory to create the switches that we use to generate the ones and zeros inside a computer that really drive everything. He was born the same year as Ada Lovelace, who was a friend of Charles Babbage, who designed the first computer in Victorian England, which was never built. And in fact, steampunk science fiction is built on the idea that it had been built in mid-Victorian England. And they say they got the computer revolution we got a century later. Now, Ada Lovelace was a brilliant, brilliant mathematician, and she saw further into Babbage's machine than even Babbage did. She sketched out the first ideas for what would be software and said how you could use it to represent things like music. So you could have music compositions and so on. So between those three people, they had all the knowledge that would have been required to have a computing revolution then.
That's Babbage, Lovelace, and you didn't mention the cobbler's son. That was George Boole.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, I didn't mention the name. And his name exists in every computing language. There's a data type called Boolean data type, which means something is either true or false, and which is incredible. His work kind of confused people at first, but then they started to get it. He was recognized as a genius. And he and Babbage actually met at the Great Exhibition in London in 1851. Babbage had a section of his computer there on display at this enormous exhibition. And Boole came and saw it and said, "What's this? How does it work?" And someone went and fetched Babbage and came back. And apparently this huge crowd kind of formed around them as the two men Babbage was explaining, and Boole was going, "Oh, well, imagine what you could do with that." And this is significant, actually, that the way we compute, it's important to say, is not the only way we could have computed. It's the one that was built very quickly under a lot of stress in the Second World War. And the first British computer was designed on a theory by Alan Turing, which he'd come up in the mid-30s. And it was used to break German codes from the Enigma machine, which was fiendishly difficult. And they worked out a way to do it by hand, but you couldn't do it quickly enough. So it was clear that they were going to have to automate this in some way. Everyone thinks Turing, if you saw the Imitation Game, the film that was about this, where Benedict Cumberbatch plays Turing, you would think Turing designed this machine and built it. Turing was not even in the country at the time. He was in America, in Pennsylvania, where the first American machine was being built to calculate kind of bomb blasts and stuff. It was a post office engineer. At the old British Post Office used to have a research division that did high-end research. And he said, "I can do this." And all the boffins at Bletchley Park, where there was a big code-breaking school, they all said, "This will never work." He said, "It will work. I can do it." And it ended up being delivered on the back of a post office truck to Bletchley Park. And it ended up with 10,000 people. 10 of these machines were built. 10,000 people were working at this code-breaking factory, basically, at Bletchley Park. The thing about that is that both there and at the first American machine, which came on stream just after the Second World War, the first programmers were all women, not like a few of them. They were all women.
All
The
women,
men
yes.
in Pennsylvania, in particular, the men went and designed this hardware. I mean, it's actually quite funny. The men built this like extraordinary thing out of all these vacuum tubes. And then came and just kind of dropped the manual on these six young, early 20-something women who had been studying math at university, which was not common then, but clearly it happened. The men were off, fighting often. And so they kind of dropped the manual and said, "Okay, you guys figure it out. We don't know what to do this thing. Tell us." And they were the ones who developed a lot of the things that are essential to programs like loops and so on. And this carried on because John von Neumann, who was heavily involved with that first machine, and the architecture of our computers is named after him, even though it's really Turing's. He thought that programming was going to be kind of dull. Turing didn't. Turing thought, "This is going to be fascinating. This is where the stuff happens." And so the early programmers were all women. By the time we got to the 60s, it was clear that this was going to be an important profession. And they decided we'd better professionalize it because coders are these kind of weird people we don't understand. And in doing that, they said, okay, you have to have a 4-year degree to do it, to make it official. And the women just dropped out because there weren't as many of them. By the mid 80s, it had recovered again. But then computer games came in. So all these young men were turning up at, university computer science departments who'd been hacking since they were kids. And they were so far in advance that the women started to kind of drop out and again dropped out. And it reached a nadir in 2015 when it got down to 5% of professional programmers were women. It hasn't really recovered from that very much.
And we're back. If you are just joining us, you are listening to Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I'm your host. We are a little more than halfway through my interview with our guest today, author Andrew Smith, talking about his new book, Devil in the Stack, A Code Odyssey. I think you can tell we kind of hit it off, had some fun conversations about programming languages. and then we went beyond programming languages, just as the book did. So don't be put off by this talk of comparing Python and Perl and JavaScript, because the book, as our conversation did, the book goes way beyond that into the history of computing and then beyond, as I'm going to play for you in the second half of the interview. Really interesting and wide-ranging book. And Andrew's a great writer to tell the story. Let's go ahead and listen to the rest of my interview with Andrew Smith, author of Devil in the Stack, here on Tectonic. You talk a lot about the programmer's mindset throughout this book. One of the questions you engage is, are great programmers born or are they made? And you come to the conclusion, as you stated earlier, anybody can become a programmer. You don't have to be some special brain type in order to fit the activity or the profession. But you do talk about the prevalence of certain neurological types, I guess we could say, in the programmer community, for better or for worse. And there is a large subset of the programming community that is, let's say, heavily left brain focused. And that, by that I mean very analytical, very rational, even hyper-rational, and maybe somewhat unemotional, and in some cases, unempathetic, finding it difficult to inhabit the perspective of somebody else. One of my favorite sections of the book is where you're really digging into this mindset that I'm talking about, and you go and you talk to an author and a psychologist and a researcher named Ian McGilchrist, who has written a couple of very influential books about left brain thinking versus right brain thinking, not just in individuals, but how this manifests in society at large. This is going to oversimplify things, but as I understand it, McGilchrist is arguing that our technological society today is far too left brain focused, which means there is a desperate need for people who are a little more balanced neurologically and maybe a little more diverse demographically to take up coding. Can you talk about what you learned when you talked to McGilchrist and how this affects all of us?
It's fascinating, this part. There's a lot of neuroscience in this book in the end, which is another thing I wasn't expecting. And I actually had two brain scans myself, one at the beginning when I was starting to learn and one when I'd been doing it for a few years. The first one was in Germany and the second one was at MIT. And I'll tell you in a minute, once I've explained some of the background, I'll tell you why that's significant. But in some ways, the story starts back in the 1960s when, as I said, the profession was professionalizing and it was more women at that point. I think by the 60s, it was probably 50-50 or so. And they didn't know what programmers needed, what skills. So like the early the early ads for programmers said, well, if you like doing crossword puzzles, if you like music, you know, anything that involved abstraction, we think you might like this. But then that didn't really seem to help. So they developed this test. They got in some sociologists to develop a thing called the programming aptitude test. And they went and looked at programmers who were already there. And they tried to find patterns. You know, what are we looking for when we look at people who can do this? And they couldn't really find any patterns except one. And the one that they found was they said, actually, programmers, they don't like people very much. So what we're looking for is people who don't really like people. And they did the programming aptitude test, basically was looking for antisocial people who are a bit awkward and don't love people. And so that, you know, that obviously colored who was there. And it also, again, was going to exclude a lot of women because, you know, women are less prone to be that way inclined. They're socialized less to be that kind of lone wolf, awkward, you know, loner. One of the things when I spoke to women at kind of conferences and stuff like that, I actually came to the conclusion that they do actively, not deliberately, but they are actually looking for recruiting for people who are left brain biased. And I'll tell you why that's important. As you mentioned, the Ian McGilchrist work is fantastic. And I went for lunch with him in London when he was down there. He lives in Scotland now. He's an extraordinary man. He began as a literature professor at Cambridge, I think, or Oxford. And then he got kind of interested in philosophy. So he moved to philosophy. So he was a philosophy professor. And he got interested in the mind-body question, which is what is the mind? Is it the same thing as the body? Or is there some kind of spirit out there? Philosophers have been debating that one for centuries. And he got very interested in it. He decided, actually, if he was going to figure that out, philosophy wasn't the thing that he needed to study. So he went and studied psychiatry. He became a psychiatrist, so psychology, psychiatry. And he ended up as running one of the most famous psychiatric hospitals in the world, the Maudsley in London, in South London, in quite a gritty part of town. And that used to be called Bethlehem, which the word bedlam actually comes from that name. And so he was there and he wrote a book. He was still doing research as well. And he wrote this book called The Master and His Emissary, which is just, I recommend anyone who wants to understand people. I mean, I just give this book to everyone I can. And I wish I'd read it in my 20s. It didn't exist then, but if it had. And what he does is in human beings and actually in all creatures that we've looked at that have brains or even central nervous systems, there is this hemispheric split so that we have left hemispheres and right hemispheres. No one traditionally really explained that. And psychologists used to kind of go, okay, the left hemisphere is in control, right? This is the masterful one who's kind of into detail and gets things done, isn't overthinking things, just kind of knows what it wants and is right and goes for that, you know, think general pattern, right? That's the left hemisphere. And they thought, well, the right hemisphere is a bit flower rangy and wishy-washy and it kind of girly. And so what we think is the left hemisphere is in charge of the right hemisphere. The right hemisphere doesn't really matter very much. Now, that's not a very satisfying explanation because obviously evolution has a way of getting rid of redundancy. So if the right hemisphere wasn't really doing anything, evolution would have gone, well, we don't need this anymore. Let's give that space to the left hemisphere. And McGilchrist came up with the first, and to my knowledge, only satisfying explanation of this bifurcation of the brain. And what he said was, it's not that they're doing different things because both hemispheres are involved in almost everything we do. But what they're doing is bringing a different kind of attention to the world. So if you think about the best way to illustrate this would be if you think about a bird who's on a forest floor looking for seeds or a worm or something like that. It needs to have a really tight focus, detail focus, to look for the seed on the floor of the forest. The left hemisphere is really good at that. The left hemisphere, we know for a fact that it deals with kind of syntax in language, for instance. It loves tight combinatorial logic. And so the bird has that part of its brain, the left hemisphere, to look for the food. But what about the cat in the bush nearby? while the bird's attention is focused on the seed and the detail, it's going to miss the cat. So it'll find the seed, but it's going to get eaten. Well, the right hemisphere has a more kind of global, outward-looking attention. It's interested in relationships and context, fitting things into context, whereas the left hemisphere wants to take things and treat them as objects out of context. So we have these two halves of the brain in order to be able to navigate the world effectively. And we need both. In the ideal world, the two things work in harmony. They're both, you know, they're great. Most of us have a bias to one or the other a bit, but mostly we're using both these things. And the fascinating thing about that is that empathy, for instance, happens in the right hemisphere, that's processed there. Things, higher functions in language like metaphor, humor, happen in the right hemisphere. And it's why very people who are very left-brained, and this would include autistic people, for instance, tend to struggle with humor, and dealing with things in context is a little bit more difficult because the left hemisphere, that's not what it does. And so what he's saying in The Master and His Emissary is that the world goes through the second half of the book, which is the more controversial one. He goes through history and looks at different periods and says, this looks like a period when the left hemisphere was in the ascendant. And the left hemisphere tends to want to dominate. The right hemisphere doesn't tend to want to dominate. It wants to work together. And there's some extraordinary experiments with this that, I really urge everyone, we don't have time to go into, but I urge everyone to have a look at that if they can. Now, this really matters because if coders are being recruited for their left hemispheric bias, and this is the kind of brain we're looking for, well, empathy is not really part of that picture. And most of the women I spoke to who were talking about going to job interviews and stuff like that, there used to be this classic one, you'll know this, there's this classic interview that tech companies do when they're recruiting coders, is there'll be a whiteboard in a room and there'll be, you know, two, three, four people from the company, experienced programmers. And they'll come and say, okay, here's a coding problem, solve this on the whiteboard with these people watching. Now, no one ever does that in code. You never have someone looking over your shoulder. I mean, maybe very occasionally, but most of the time you're not. And you're never writing it down in front of other people under that kind of pressured situation. Who's going to thrive in that? Not women, not most women. It's going to be the people who are not very socially sensitive, who don't care that three people are watching and don't have that. So all the women I spoke to said, yeah, this really is not a good way of doing it. And it's starting to change now. But that was a subtle way that really for decades, no one noticed that there was unconsciously people with left hemispheric biases were being recruited. And you see it in the software being written, because as people do point out these days, you know, software, writing good software is an exercise in empathy. You're trying to think your way into people's thought processes and lives, you know, from the get-go.
And if you extend this to the entire society, in which, as we said at the very beginning, code is infiltrating into every aspect of our existence, if that code was written in a mindset and in these institutional processes that lack empathy, that treat people as objects and look at situations completely devoid of any context, well, then you're likely to build a dystopia that looks a whole lot like the one we're living through today. And
precisely.
That's one of the many things I appreciated about this book, is that it fit in some puzzle pieces, how the dystopia that we live in today, dominated by these unethical big tech firms, comes from a certain series of events in history and different personalities that acted in certain ways and had certain outcomes.
That's exactly right. That's very well put.
And you finish the book, I'm just going to give a teaser here, no spoiler, but you finish the book by revealing that there is, in fact, a devil in the stack.
Yeah.
It's not just a clever phrase that you used for the title, the stack being the programming environment from the low-level code near the processor all the way up to the high level stuff that faces the user interface. That whole stack of programming code hiding inside somewhere is a particular devil that you make a very persuasive case is responsible for many of the corporate sins like amplifying disinformation and fraying the social fabric and global tax avoidance. I could go on, but there's a particular devil, and it fits right in with what we've just been talking about. But I'm not going to reveal what it is because people are going to have to either buy the book from their local independent bookstore or check it out from their local public library and definitely not order it from a certain monopoly. But in the end, I found this book was a combination of a warning against big tech's predations, but at the same time, it was a love letter to coding itself. Because I feel like you really developed a love for programming for all the right reasons. And you're showing that there is a way that coding can be good and beautiful and totally separate from the horrible things that people like Mark Zuckerberg and Steve Ballmer have unleashed.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I mean, that was the thing that surprised me most. The idea that I was ever going to go native and really love this. It surprised me. And in some ways, although it looks very different from my other books, my first one was about, it's called Moondust, and it was about the guys who walked on the moon. And I really wondered there, I wondered where you go after you've been to the moon, you know, 12 of them that did it. And, you know, I'd heard that some of them came back and had big breakdowns. Other ones went on really unexpected paths. And one became a new age guru in Florida after he thought he sensed an intelligence in the universe on the way back. And he spent the rest of his life trying to figure that out. Another one became a painter and he just endlessly painted scenes from the moon landing. He's one of the happiest man I ever knew. That was really about, in some ways, that's about technology, but it's really about technology as a reflection of us. And the second book was about the, you know, who killed Web 1.0, which basically the first iteration of the web just wiped out in the early 2000s. And it was a mystery. How did this happen? Why did it happen? And in actual fact, the explanations for it that were given, which was, hey, these stupid kids did it, totally wrong. It's way more complex and interesting. And this I regard the same because we made this environment. It's basically, I call it the microcosmos because it's like the first human-made environment, really, our code environment. And it's a reflection of us. We built that. And so everything about it is that. And in the end, this book is a book about people, which I could spend three lifetimes trying to figure us out. Never will. But this is another piece of the puzzle, I think, as you say. I mean, the most fascinating. I just think we don't really, because computers become mundane to us. But these things that we've made and this environment is incredible, isn't it? I mean, you know.
Yeah, it is. And you've painted a really inviting and engaging portrait of programming and its history and its effects. I really recommend this book to Tectonic listeners. The book is called Devil in the Stack, A Coding Odyssey by my guest today, Andrew Smith. Andrew, thanks so much for being on the show today.
Thank you, Mark. I enjoyed that so much. Thank you.
And we're back. If you are just tuning in, you are listening to Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I'll be your host for the remainder of the hour here on the show. Thanks for joining. We just heard my interview with author Andrew Smith talking about his new book, which I liked a lot, Devil in the Stack, A Code Odyssey, published by Grove Atlantic. And you can find a link to the book and other things that Andrew brought up during the interview on the playlist. You can go to tectonic.fm, that's T-E-C-H, tonic.fm, or you can go to wfmu.org and click playlists and comments, where we've had a bunch of good comments during this hour. Before I get to some comments about the interview and my reflections on the book, I just wanted to say something about the show, just to take a step back just for a moment. As I mentioned a couple of weeks ago, Tectonic is beginning to syndicate our episodes to local independent radio stations around the country. And I want to say welcome to another station that has put Tectonic on its weekly schedule. That is KABF. That's in Little Rock, Arkansas. KABF 88.3 FM. Welcome, everybody from Little Rock who's listening in. They're airing the episodes on Tuesday evenings at 7 p.m. local there in Little Rock, and really happy to have them with us. If you, listener, want to have your local independent radio station carry Tectonic, it's really easy. Just tell your station to go to tectonic.fm, T-E-C-H, tonic.fm, and there are instructions on that one-page website for what to do. Or they can just email us at syndication@wfmu.org, or you can always reach me at mark@wfmu.org. And we're going to continue to try to reach out to stations and bring them into the fold so that we can share messages of love and enlightenment about technology and how it affects us and to the world at large, and to put spotlights on authors and journalists and innovators and everybody that we have on the show who are trying to tell the truth or do something really significant with technology that is that shows that technology can be good. And to bring it back to Andrew's book, that was what I walked away with. As I told Andrew, I felt like his book was a reflection of his discovery that he loves programming. And not to say that everyone would love programming if they try it out, but to say that there is a community out there for you. If you want to dive into programming or anything else with technology, there's a community out there for you that will support you, that will include you, and that will encourage you to do something positive with this technology. This really is a pro-technology book. This is not an anti-technology book at all. But as I brought up in the interview, Andrew is making a point to describe the negatives, where they come up in his argument or in his history or in his experiences. He's pointing out the negatives that so often flow from the companies where power has concentrated. These are the unethical tech giants, Facebook, Google, and the others in Silicon Valley and Washington State. There is a difference in how we relate to technology that is determined by the power structure. If you are at a company that is, you know, worth a trillion or 2 trillion or more dollars, that is based its business model on deceiving people and exploiting people and manipulating people and growing at any cost, if you're working for that kind of company, you're likely contributing to harmful effects because of technology. And that's what I'm against on this show. I'm not against technology. I'm against the improper use of technology, the arrogant misuse of technology. Whereas there is another side to technology exemplified by Andrew and the people he encountered at the Python convention and other places he writes about, where people are doing things because they love it, because they want to fix a problem in their local municipality, and they're using some open data from the city or town to do something positive, to serve citizens better, or they're doing something because they just love, as Andrew does, programming with music and synthesizing music through the wonder of programmatic computing interfaces. He talked about a language called SuperCollider, which I've linked on the playlist. And that's a whole rabbit hole you can dive into as well. I think that's totally positive. And it's a great thing for people to be able to dive in together and to learn these things together. It's about inclusivity and encouragement. In other words, all the things that Steve Ballmer was against in saying that the open source movement was terrible, it's communist, let's not have that. Those are the things that I'm in favor of. I'm in favor of people helping each other and using technology to help the world in some way. And this being the last show of the year, I thought I could just end on a positive note. Let's end 2024 on a positive note. Technology can be good, in other words. And this book, Devil in the Stack, A Code Odyssey by Andrew Smith, shows us that it is, in fact, possible. As somebody put it, and this was Baz in the Netherlands on the comment board just now on WFMU.org, coding serves so many purposes and needs a variety of brains. And that's so true, that the best kind of coding community is one that's going to be inclusive of everyone. Wherever they are, if we want to talk about the spectrum, include everybody who's anywhere on the spectrum or not, men and women, any ethnicity, any background, anyone who wants to be involved should be included and should be encouraged. And when we have an inclusive community, as the comment says, coding needs a variety of brains. We need everybody. We need a diversity of people who are going to be building the technology to help build whatever comes next, as opposed to the approach from big tech, which concentrates power and looks for a narrow solution that serves the company's purposes only and socializes all of the losses and the harms and the waste on the rest of us, the exact opposite of the open source movement. I'd like to see an inclusive and encouraging and positive approach to technology. And I think this book shows that it's possible. I also was very happy to see that Andrew Smith was telling a history of computing and making a point of showing, as I've covered on some past shows some time ago, the gender split at the beginning, in which computers, originally the original use of the term computer, was referring to women who were carrying out the calculations with pencil and paper and slide rule for the Aberdeen Proving Grounds, where the U.S. military was testing artillery, and the computers, in the absence of digital computers, the computers were women who were doing the mathematical work. And then, as he points out, as programmable computers came online, again, the first programmers using the computers, programming the computers, were women, because it was considered a man's job to do the quote-unquote heavy lifting of designing the hardware. But as soon as the center of power and money and influence was understood to be located in the software, well, all of a sudden everything flipped, and now software became a man's job. And women are just not are not suited for this sort of work, which is totally wrong, of course. But it was interesting to see this again in this history, and he's drawing on other histories that other authors have brought up, that women at first were told, you can be a computer or you can be a programmer, because that's not so important. And in fact, as I understand, in the early days, the message was women are suited to computer programming because that requires abstract thought, as housewives do. The message was in coming up with grocery lists for the family. And that's the kind of abstract kind of thinking that women are good at, whereas men are good at designing the hardware. And then again, as soon as the power was found to be in designing the software, well, then all of a sudden it became, well, women just aren't suited for the abstract thought of programming. See how that works? So I was happy to see that aspect of computing history was pointed out, and again, points to the need for more work to make programming and coding generally a more inclusive community for everyone, for all sorts of brains. And also, yes, I recommend looking into Ian McGilchrist and the book The Master and His Emissary, also his follow-up book, actually a two-volume book called The Matter with Things. I have to admit, I have read none of Ian McGilchrist's work, but I have seen him interviewed, and I have some very, very basic familiarity with his arguments, and it just makes me want to read his books. But my to-read book list is growing ever, ever larger. And several of the books on the to-read list are coming at you, listeners, because they are queued up for future Tectonic episodes. It is about time for me to wrap, friends. I want to remind you that you have some homework until I come back the next time, and that is, I want you to avoid Apple, abandon Amazon, forget Facebook, and whatever you do, get off Google. And we've got another outro. Thanks to brother Daniel Blumen for delivering another strike here this evening. This song is called Silicon Chip by Basil Kirchin. Enjoy it, friends, and see you next time. And stay tuned for Dave Mandel. You're listening to the greatest radio station in the world, WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, in New York City and Rockland County, 91.9 FM, and online at WFMU.org.
Ladies and gentlemen, good evening and welcome to another installment, the last installment of the year, as a matter of fact, of my program, It's Complicated, an hour of Prague and Prague-adjacent music. Welcome. Thanks for tuning in. And we're going to start tonight's show with something I've been on my list for the last, you know, 4 or 5 weeks. I've got to play this track just to prevent my brain from exploding, because every week it's on my list and I never seem to get to it. Well, that's all going to change right now. We're going to hear a track, not the first one and probably not the last, from a collection called Maximum Prague, 16 rare gems from the golden age of British progressive rock. Pretty good collection, and it's mostly, well, as the title sort of implies, from the early days of Prague, or right on the threshold of Prague, so it's kind of the roots of Prague mostly. And this track I'm going to play is a good example of that, by a guy named Don Shin. That's Shin with two N's, S-H-I-N, and Don Shin. And you'll hear it's kind of a, you know, founding father kind of thing with the heavy Hammond organ and stuff, reminiscent, I guess, of the Nice, probably Keith Emerson's band, who is kind of considered the first prog band, actually, the Nice. Anyway, this is Don Shin, a track called A Minor Explosion. Then, suitably bombastic ending from Don Shin, a piece called A Minor Explosion. Did anyone check, confirm whether that track was actually in A minor? I don't have perfect pitch. Probably. It was in a minor key. I'll tell you that much. I know that. Again, track from a collection called Maximum Prog. 16 rare gems from the golden age of British progressive rock. Even this collection is rare, and I had to go on bended knee to my colleagues here at FMU, several of which, of course, had copies of it. We're going to hear something a little more recent and definitely more unquestionably Prague, and that is a group called Bondage Fruit. You didn't get band names like that in 1970, I'll tell you. And they're Japanese. We're going to hear a piece from a 1999 release called Four, you know, Roman numeral Four, their fourth album, Bondage Fruit. They are sometimes referred to, should I stop saying this? They're sometimes referred to as a Zuhl group, Z-E-U-H-L, which is the subgenre of Prague, sort of invented by the group Magma. Actually, just in my travels in my research for this show, I see that I'm starting to see that term thrown around pretty recklessly. Everyone, you know, everyone but your mom is referred to as Zuhl. Some of them are, some maybe not. Anyway, you decide. Great track from the group Bondage Fruit. Again, they're Japanese, and this is from a 1999 release.